Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and join me in the second chair tonight, that wonderful, wild, wacky pundit from the anti-Semite. Did I say anti-Semite? I should mention that he's an anti-Semite, too. Everybody's telling him that today. My good friend Jazz Shaw of Hot Air. Jazz, how's it going? You anti-Semite, you?
Well, clearly Snow is Jewish because I'm in the Northeast, and I'm going to go find Al Gore and punch him in the nose because we have been snowed upon, Rick, for weeks on end. I have run out of places to put the snow, and now they're saying we have 3 more weeks of snow coming. And really, I'm done. Okay, Winter,
done?
You and I, we're breaking up. Normally I would say, well, it's not you, it's me. No, it's you. It's the snow, and I'm done with it because we are snowed in, Rick. And this is New York. We're used to it, but this is like the worst winter we have had since probably 2003.
Well, it's climate change. Of course it is. Why are you going to punch Al Gore in the nose when he's right? When he's right.
Exactly.
He's right on the button.
Global warming has caused me to be buried, and my shed is about to collapse. God.
You know, and this brings up an interesting observation, Jazz. And I don't know if you feel this way, although living in northern climes, you very well might. I find that the older I get, the less tolerant I am of winter. And, you know, because I can remember as a kid going out ice skating when it's 15 below, and I'd stay out for 20, 25 minutes at a time, come back in, get some gun, come into the shelter, get some hot chocolate, and go out for another 25. And spend hours doing that, and of course playing in the snow. And you're getting now here I am. If I have to, you know, go out to the car, if I have to drive somewhere first, I first of all warm the car up for 20 minutes to make sure it's nice and toasty inside, and then I run out to the car so I don't get cold. I'm definitely moving south somewhere. Not Florida, not Alabama, not the Gulf Coast, probably Arizona, where they have some nice crunchy cons there that I'd probably feel right at home with. So, yeah, I just think that's right. Do you feel the same way?
I'm getting there, and I think I am following the pattern of my mom. My mom and her sister, my Aunt Barbara, they're both living back up in upstate New York now. God only knows why. But after my dad passed away, they had put their money together and they went to Arizona. And they went in together and bought a little timeshare thing. And they started spending the winters in Arizona. And at the time, I was like, what are you doing? That's crazy. You're going to the desert Southwest. The family's up here. Nobody sees you at Christmas. I'm now up, and I'm not going to speculate on your age because the lovely and talented Rick Moran is probably still only in his 20s, but I'm approaching the 60 mark. And at this point, I'm thinking, you know, the desert's looking pretty good. So I see why my mom went there. You know, it gets old. You have the old bones, you know, it's like
yep.
The cold hits you harder.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
And I was out there shoveling, and I realize this is a political show. Nobody wants to hear this. But in almost 60 years, I have failed to learn that you should not shovel the driveway apron until after the plow goes by.
Yes.
Because this morning I actually went out and shoveled it again and was just finishing as the plow went by and filled it back in. And I threw the shovel in the road, and I was like, okay, that's it. I'm leaving. I'm going to go fish for tarpon in Florida or something. Oh, my God. No, Rick, this winter has been brutal. It has been brutal.
Yeah. Well, luckily, the economy is so bad here that we get a parade of adults, sometimes with their sons, to come to our house asking if we want the driveway shelved. So, yeah, we pay $20, $25, get it done. We don't have to do it. I've got a bad back. She's got a bad hip. So, you know, we save ourselves a lot of aggravation.
I made a lot of money as a kid doing that. There are no kids up here doing that today. None. And there are young people in this neighborhood. And I used to go around in the morning before school and take a shovel. And, well, back then you got like $3 to $5. But that was a ton of money in the 60s, you know. And if you did, you know, 7, 8, 10 driveways, you come home with like $40. And to my dad,
you'd be a candy and gum for a month. Candy and gum for a month.
Amount of money to my parents. Exactly. You know, but it doesn't happen. I got nobody coming around offering a shovel. So there's a hint for you, Northeast kids. Get a shovel. Get out there. Make an offer. You can be a capitalist. That's how you start. I'll pay you $20. Show up tomorrow.
Well, now that we've spent 10 minutes talking about the weather, not quite 10, 9.
I apologize. I apologize.
Right.
It's been on my mind.
That's all right. We're going to have fun a little later with Bridget Johnson of PJ Media, who's going to come talk about Brian Williams. But in the meantime, we have another media personality in the news.
Oh, my God. Is Bridget not one of the smartest people you know? I mean,
she's one of the smartest, loveliest people.
She is a very good journalist. I have talked
to her many times.
And also a master of the English language, and I appreciate that.
Yes. And she's going to tell us her perspective from the perspective of a journalist, because she not only writes for PJ Media, but before that she worked for the Rocky Mountain News out in Denver. So she's a bona fide journalist, unlike you and me, Jazz, who are are we?
We're low class hacks, really.
You go. Yeah. Thomas Paine was one of these guys. What do you call Thomas Paine?
we're pamphleteers.
Not that we're Thomas Paine.
Yes. Sam Adam.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, she'll be joining us in about 5-7 minutes. In the meantime, another media personality is in the news, and he's making news because he's leaving his show. Jon Stewart of The Daily Show is going to leave sometime later this year. And it's kind of rocking the, I imagine it's rocking Twitter. I can imagine, you know, that it's, social media is exploding. But what's your take on this, Jazz? Do you think he's going to move on to like the network TV late night, which is where
I think he's going to retire. I believe he's retiring. And he just produced a movie last year. Rosewater, I don't know if you saw it, pretty good film about life for journalists inside of Iran. Very good film. I did get to watch it. I thought it was well done. The reason Jon Stewart is leaving is because, as you know, I appeared on The Daily Show this year, and I believe that is what drove Jon Stewart off the air. It was just one appearance by me. I was only there for a minute and a half, and that was it. It set the dominoes tumbling, and after Jazz Shaw appeared on The Daily Show, the clock started ticking, and now Jon Stewart is leaving. So there's your answer. So mystery solved.
Yeah. Well, you and I were talking a little bit before the show about Jon Stewart, and I made the point that I said at the time that you violently disagreed with, nearly took my head off. I said that, yeah, Jon Stewart is biased, but, you know, he goes after the left, too. And let's face it, there's more fodder on the right as far as comedy material than there is on the left these days. I mean, who could resist a guy who says it's beautiful to have a baby from rape? I mean, who could resist that? That's crazy. That's just downright crazy. Anyway,
and the only reason I disagree with that, Rick, is that it depends what you find funny. I mean, you can find great humor in the things that Bernie Sanders says. You can find great humor in the things that Chuck Schumer says when he says things like, well, the government should nationalize the energy industry. And it's like, well, dude, do you realize you're talking about essentially a socialist government? You know, but that's not good humor. So it's not as funny, but it should be. So, yeah, he's got easier targets with Republicans. I agree. But, no, John Stewart, I think, always has been very much a leftist, very much a liberal. He enjoys taking pot shots at conservatives more than he does liberals. But to his credit, best example being Anthony Weiner, when somebody on the left does something really dumb, yeah, he'll make fun of that. He'll take shots. And Anthony Weiner was actually a roommate of his in college, and he made fun of him. So you didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that.
He was a room, you know, yeah, he was close friends and a roommate with Anthony Weiner, and he made fun of him, of an actual friend of his. So yeah, he gets credit for that. But no, he was completely a leftist. The show was probably at least 85-90% geared towards making fun of Republicans and conservatives, and occasionally spiced it up with making fun of Democrats and liberals. I don't know. So he's leaving. But let's not pretend he was totally even-handed. He did make fun of both sides, but he had a definite bias. My point was that he didn't apologize for it. He made it very clear he was a Democrat. He did a live show with Stephen Colbert the night that Barack Obama was first elected, and he literally broke into tears when the results came in. And Barack Obama was elected. He broke into tears. That's how happy he was. So, and that's fine. My wife did the same thing. I'm in a mixed marriage. A lot of people don't know that. My wife's not black, but she is a Democrat. So, you know, we have a mixed marriage. But, okay, I'm getting a little scattershot with the comedy here. But the point is, yeah, he did both sides, but he was a leftist, and now he's leaving. And what will Comedy Central do? Do you replace that? Because, you know, the guy he replaced was only there for a short period of time. Who do you get to take that chair, Rick?
That's a good question. Maybe Colbert ends his show and comes back to Daily Show. What do you think?
No, he's already got a job. He's taking over for Letterman, right? So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I don't follow this kind of crap. The culture is one thing that just does not interest me. I mean,
really?
Why bother? Well, you know, movies, I occasionally watch a movie if there's enough explosions and naked women in it. You know, I'll watch it then. You know, but some of these movies I wouldn't, sir.
Explosions are not funny.
Of course they are. They may not be funny.
I mean,
they're viscerally satisfying.
You can't have too many explosions. Naked women are fine, but moving along.
Yeah. So, no, I don't watch movies. I have no clue who some of these singers are. And the only reason I know some of them is because they're in the news for other reasons besides their songs. I don't give a rat's ass about jazz today, which has just fallen apart. You know.
Well, I don't care about Rick either.
You meant
jazz music. Oh, all right.
And I haven't read a novel in 20 years, so I don't care about the culture. You know, if it wants to be leftist and all anti-American, it's fine with me. I'll just keep living my life and having a good time watching my Bulls and White Sox and Hawks and Cubs and
sure.
and the Spire. And then, you know, I just don't care. I really, really don't. And maybe that's a function of age. I'm 61 years old, in case you wanted to know. I'm 61 years old and I don't care.
I don't know. I honestly have to say I enjoyed The Daily Show. The spinoff that John Oliver did on HBO, he has a weekly show that he does. I've watched that also, very liberal leaning, but, you know, really funny. I like some of the cultural stuff. I mean, I think it plays in and it does speak to people. And I think it's not real news, but I think it does impact the electorate. And beyond that, the talented ones, and I think John Oliver, he's a Brit, but, you know, he's very talented. And I enjoy it. I've always enjoyed it. So yeah. I think in a way I will kind of miss Jon Stewart because he was a funny guy.
Hello? I think we dropped. Oh, there you are. Okay. It sounded like you dropped out for a second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You
I
still
just
there?
Had this great riff. Wow, yeah, I'm still
yeah.
there.
Okay, good. Okay, great. Let's. Yeah, John Stewart can ride off in the sunset, and I'm sure he'll has a nice retirement plan with all the money he's made. So we'll move on now and bring on our guest for this evening from PJ Media's Washington editor, Bridget Johnson. Bridget, thanks for joining us. Talk about the story of the day. I don't know if you saw this. Quantum equation predicts universe has no beginning or no end. You want to talk about that with us?
Brian Williams, it's a
fascinating.
No beginning and no end? What?
Well, there's no. It basically disproves the Big Bang.
Yes.
Which is earth-shaking, actually, in the physics world. But, of course, the equations have to be vetted, and that'll take a year because, you know, they're so frickin' complicated. But the point being, good news, the universe is never going to end.
Exactly, and it never began, Bridget. So we would like to ask you, since you don't exist, what do you think about not existing?
I think existence for being non-existent is pretty enjoyable.
There you go. Perfect
Bingo.
Answer,
We're
which
done.
Is why we have you on this show.
Thanks
what
for coming,
about,
everybody.
Bro? Yeah, have a good night.
Back to work. Okay, thanks, guys.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to talk about Brian Williams because everybody else is. Why not us? Brian Williams, interesting situation. I didn't send around this New York Times article about the fall of Brian Williams in trustworthiness. But it's evidently there's a metric out there that is used by advertisers and networks about celebrities who are trustworthy, and they rank them. And before this kerfluffle with the Iraq War helicopter story, Brian Williams was ranked 25th, which is very high for a news person. After this incident, he's now ranked 830th. 830.
Is he below Kanye West? Or
probably. Is NBC going to put somebody ranked 830th in the trustworthy area back on the air? Or is Brian Williams being handed his hat and shown to the door?
No, I think we've you know, I've been in the news business for my whole career and, you know, through many newsrooms. And when you have a suspension that's that long, there is ample opportunity, shall we say, for other people to come and fill in the hole and show how much better they can do and how they can, you know, restore what was lost to some degree of greatness. So I think that if he comes back to NBC, it will be as some host of some stupid special or something and not, you know, as the anchor of the nightly news. It'll be some special correspondent BS role.
Yeah, isn't that what they did to Dan Rather at CBS? They took, eased him out of the anchor chair and let him do like two or three of these, you know, special reports, and then he was gone. Isn't that how they handled the Dan Rather situation in the Jazz? Do you remember?
No, actually, I think he maintained most of his credibility with his organization for quite a while.
Well, he was gone
I'm
within
sorry,
the
I...
year. Yeah. Oh, was that sarcasm?
He was gone within the year, but he was not gone as a disgraced personality amongst his organization. Dan Rather lost all of his credibility with the public. There's no question about that. And when I wrote the piece that I referenced to you offline about why I felt a little bit bad for Bryant Williams, I actually used that as the guidepost, saying that, you know, what Bryant Williams did was actually very different than what Dan Rather did. I mean, the fake but accurate thing, that should be the end for anyone who purports to report the news. Yeah, Bridget works in that industry. When you go do the fake but accurate thing, that should be the end of your life. What Bryant Williams did was kind of somewhat different, but the media let Dan Rather off with a pass, I think, and he was allowed to retire and kind of sail off into the sunset, and it's like, well, yeah, he made a mistake, and maybe that wasn't right, but the point he was trying to make, and that was the big caveat that was always added, well, that's why it was fake but accurate. He was making a point, you know. I don't think Bryant Williams is facing the exact same situation, do you? Because he wasn't making up things about the Iraq War, about laying down bridges. He wasn't making up things about how bad the flood was in Katrina. He was sort of doing that drunk Uncle Mel sort of thing where he inserted himself into the story, and instead of saying, there were helicopters being shot at, well, I remember when I was shot down, you know, and, you know, in Katrina, well, I watched the bodies floating by. It's like your uncle that, you know, went on a fishing trip and got a legal-sized bass, and 30 years later, it almost tipped the canoe over. You know, it's a little bit, all I was saying, and I understand it clouds the rest of the things he reports, but the facts we have about the things that he was saying that were incorrect, he wasn't doing a Dan Rather thing saying, well, I have this information that shows that Bush did this and the country should distrust this and this was all entirely. He was more like, well, there I was. And I had these three girls in my penthouse letter, you know, declares. It was along those lines. So, Bridget, I mean, is there a difference between Dan Rather and Bryant Williams from what I'm saying?
No, I get exactly what you're saying because, you know, I wouldn't. My whole career has been in print journalism, and from the earliest moments, you know, I saw the kind of there's a pretty strong dislike between print journalists and broadcast journalists, and basically because the broadcast journalists are more full of themselves, you know, they're seen as more trying to do that embellishment, trying to get the more sensational side of the story. You know, I remember when I was a Cub reporter in Santa Cruz, California, and, you know, I was going for one of the press parking spaces at the courthouse, and I just missed one, and I start to, like, back up, and this broadcast reporter comes, and she just reverses and guns at me and makes me, like, go back just so she could get that parking space, and she would have hit me.
Drive you physically out of there.
Yeah, so that was the kind of attitude, you know, we kind of got exposed to early on with the whole broadcast versus print in the same sort of press pool there. So I guess, you know, I see exactly what you're saying as far as the drunk uncle embellishment, but, you know, I think that's just something that you kind of, I think, find more in the broadcast world than the print world a lot, too, you know, because they're putting their faces out there. They want to sound cooler than the next guy. They want to have the best
right.
I was there story. And, yeah, so I think that's what we're looking at here.
Yeah, the big difference, Jazz and Bridget, is that Williams never made these exaggerations on air. Or if he did, they were not in the context of a news broadcast. Most of the Iraq War story came from a book written by David Brinkley. A book written by David Brinkley, where he embellished the helicopter being shot down. And of course, he on certain panels and stuff, he's been repeating that story for years. As far as the Katrina lies, and there were several lies there about the dead body floating by when there was no flood. I mean, the Ritz-Carlton was high and dry. There was no way you could have seen a dead body float by. The gangs did not take over the Ritz-Carlton. They interviewed the former general manager of the Ritz-Carlton, who said, where'd he get that? That's crazy. And this dysentery story is falling apart, too, because evidently he said he declined an IV because other people needed it more than he did, except that they had a very well-stocked MASH unit in the hotel. And
but it was really heroic, Rick. It was really heroic.
Of course it was. So his Katrina tall tales, again, not told on camera, are falling apart, too. My favorite, though, guys, is the puppies. The puppies. When he was a volunteer firefighter in Connecticut or wherever, and he crawled on his hands and knees through a smoky, burning house. He reached under a bed and felt something soft and fluffy. He grabbed it and put it under his coat. And when he got outside, two beautiful eyes were looking up at him in gratitude, or whatever, however he describes it. Or four. Version of the story, he got one poppy. Another version, he got two. So, you know, that's my favorite. I don't know. You know, does this say anything at all about the rest of journalism? And I'm talking about big time journalism here, because we all can name reporters and columnists with incredible integrity. And talent and all that, but in big time news, and I'm talking when you get up in the upper echelons of broadcast news and the upper echelons of cable news, do you think that this is commonplace, that people exaggerate their daring do in order to make an impression on people?
When you get into those upper echelons, they're not just looking for somebody who has journalism skills but has a pretty face. So I think that, you know, you may be in the upper echelons of being in the prime time spot on the news, but you might not exactly be the most skilled or, you know, ethics-driven person who's in that position. You know, you may be the best-looking one who can read the news the best and you know, go out there and put on a flak jacket and pretend like you're, you know, doing some war reporting, when we have the, you know, more hardcore war reporters who, you know, as we've seen, have gotten into some very bad scrapes lately. But so I think that in broadcast journalism, when they're competing so much for ratings and for, you know, pulling in certain demographics and wanting somebody who has the right look, I think it's kind of at that point that they can start to skimp on what qualifications a person has for a job.
Well, I can offer something else for you, Bridget, and I wish I was trying to do some research before the show started. There was a reporter in New Jersey during the Hurricane Sandy incident, who was out there, and I'm trying to find the right words. I don't want to make this too sensationalist or insulting, but they had a camera crew, and they positioned a woman out somewhere in New Jersey who was sitting in a canoe. I don't know if any of you remember this. She was sitting in a canoe next to a street sign because there was water in the street, and they were filming the interview with her, and she had a paddle and she was holding herself steady in, quote, the current. And there was current. There was water. It was a bad storm. Nobody would deny that it was a bad storm. And while they were filming it live, and it's still available on YouTube, and I was looking for the clip before the show started, two guys with a six-pack of beer, walked behind her. And the water came up to about, not even mid-calf, like a little above the ankle. So it was deep enough water to float a canoe. But the water really was about 8 inches deep. You know, and they're trying to make the case, like, wow, look at me. I'm a brave reporter. I'm out here. I'm in the middle of Sandy, you know, and there's all this stuff going on, and I'm paddling my way just to bring you the news, and there's two co-eds back there with a six-pack of Budweiser walking behind you. At that point, you lose a little bit, I think, of the credibility of saying how bad the story is. But at the same time, Rick, this goes back to what I was saying about Brian Williams. It doesn't mean there wasn't a bad thing happening. There was a very, very bad thing happening. People died, and there was tremendous damage and all that stuff. But they sell the news as entertainment. And, Bridget, do you think there's an element of news as entertainment which cheapens the value of the news part of it?
Yeah, and I think that you know, setting up, you know, shots that look more dramatic and, you know, embellishing shots and things like that, I think that's something that's always been done, but just now they get caught more because everybody has cameras.
Right.
And Twitter exists, and people are able to put out these photos. But, you know, we also kind of see, like, the online version of it with, you know, do you just look at how, like, the Daily Mail sets up their stories online? It could be the exact same story, you know, of what's happening that you might see on, you know, Weekly Standard or CNN.com or something. But on the Daily Mail, it's, you know, you're clicking on that and, oh, my God, it looks more exciting. You know, you have, you know, they're picking the right photos. They're putting them in the right order. They're putting the right dramatic text with them and the pull-out boxes and quotes and everything. So I think that, I think that's definitely an example of how, you know, you could take two exact same stories and kind of, you know, pull out one for more entertainment value.
Yeah, whenever I hear a discussion like this, I think immediately of Paddy Chayefsky's Network, which was, I think, 1977.
Yes.
But, I mean, just, it was like the guy was seeing the future. You know, it's just, it was just amazing. Of course, it's not quite as show busy, but it is, in a way. And Theodore H. White, the old Time magazine reporter, also predicted something similar. When he wrote his book, and it was the last book he wrote about the news media and how they no longer report the story as a matter of who, what, when, how, where, why. Rather, now it is dramatized. There must be a pace to the news story. There must be a beginning and an end. There has to be villains and heroes. And that kind of perspective plays right into the hands of media bias, I think, much more so than even straight news reporting used to in the old New York Times, the old Washington Post. I mean, you know, you can say what you want to about Bernstein and Woodward, but if you go back and read those stories, they were very, very careful in not drawing conclusions, but rather allowing the reader to draw their own conclusions. You don't do that anymore. You gotta draw the conclusion and slap the reader's face with it, which is what the New York Times does quite often. So, do you sense that in especially on cable news, where, you know, when 24-hour news first came on, I was ecstatic. I mean, oh, now we're gonna get all these good foreign stories. We're going to get 5 to 7 to 9 minutes of hard-hitting journalism. No. What it is a 30-minute news broadcast every 30 minutes. And then they do the same damn thing over the next 30 minutes. And if there's a new story that breaks, fine. You know, but it is just absolutely flummoxed me how this has turned out, Bridget.
Well, it's because we're all under pressure to get drudge hits. So I don't care what media outlet it is. You know, we're all under pressure now to have this shocking sound bite, the shocking statistic. And, of course, on drudge, if it's something about, you know, lesbians adopting puppies or something like that, you know, of course, that pushes it to the top of the list. But, yeah, there's so much much pressure now to kind of be featured in this kind of, you know, niche market that draws everybody to this pool to decide what stories they're going to click on, they're going to read. And then also, you know, in a lot of ways too, it's, you know, finding where you're going to be in the Google search results and the, you know, search traffic. So I think there's kind of new weird pressures on it that kind of, you know, almost drive it away from journalism at times. You know, I remember when I was at the LA Daily News and the managing editor, he used to work at the National Enquirer, and he said what they would do is they would hand you a headline and then you wrote the story.
Oh, jeez.
And you kind of feel that sometimes it's that way now. It's like, okay, so what's going to get everybody's attention? All right, something that says this. All right, so what supports that?
All right, well, first of all, I want to say that I need to get Bridget offline afterwards because I have nothing at Hot Air about the lesbians adopting puppies. So I want to get the scoop on that. But Bridget, let me circle back to what Rick just said, though, because I think it's a great example. When you go back to Woodward and Bernstein, that wasn't a case of a flood or a thunderstorm or a hurricane or a terrorist attack or something where somebody would go and insert themselves in the middle and go, and oh, well, here I am, and the gunfire's bursting. They actually did some digging. And they went and they got the guy in the garage, and yeah, maybe they dramatized Deep Throat a bit, and we didn't find out for sure for years later, you know, who that was. But they were going and finding a story and reporting on it. And I don't think until All the President's Men came out that they ever inserted themselves in the story. It was always about the news, wasn't it? And isn't that... And feel free to disagree with me. I mean, that's sort of a dividing line between what we're talking about now with Brian Wilson and what we saw when somebody broke the Watergate story, because that was not about them. Very few people at the time, in my opinion, knew the names of the reporters until later.
Right.
They were just talking about the story. And now it's like, well, how can I make myself part of the story, or am I just off base on that?
I think that's something that you see a lot less in print. You know, I know a lot of, you know, print guys who they, you know, you have to push and pull and prod them to get them on a news broadcast. They're like, no, I'm here for a reason because I look this way, you know, and I just want to stay, you know, behind my computer and you know, write a story and send it out, and it has my byline, and that's it. And it's actually been a lot of drama, I should say, in print newsrooms when the online revolution happened and they wanted print reporters to put themselves out there more, to make themselves into Twitter personalities, et cetera. And there was a lot of resistance from a lot of, you know, veteran journalists in print newsrooms. So there has been that sort of clash there. And as far as the type of work that Woodward and Bernstein were doing, too, I think because of, you know, drastic cutbacks across a lot of newsrooms, there's just not the staff to be able to do deep dives, you know, long investigative reports like that, like Woodward and Bernstein were fortunately able to do, when it's more of an instant gratification news culture, where, you know, you have to get, you know, a story out there that people will click on, and you have, you know, a day max to work on it. So I think that I don't really see, you know, a lot of the, you know, make me a star sort of attitude that maybe, you know, Brian Williams is suffering a bit from, at least not in print newsrooms. I think in broadcast it's always been there for, you know, journalists to want to kind of set themselves out above the pack, and now as it is, you know, compete for the cable news jobs, et cetera. But
usually I jump right back over and let Rick take the next question, but nobody asked you the one question I want to hear you answer, Bridget. And if you would, you worked in the industry, you have a history, you know what the ethics are that are involved. Clearly, you've been following the story. Should NBC dump Brian Wilson? Is that an unpardon? Is it a is it a mortal sin or is it a venial sin?
I think that because this has been so publicized, because news outlets face this sort of new storm with, you know, Twitter and Facebook that they wouldn't have had before as far as exposure of what somebody did, they are probably feeling that they want to either let him go or put him in a corner somewhere where he'll just do his little, you know, Brian Williams Christmas special or something like that. So I think that it's the sort of thing that would have been a venial sin, but social media exposure may have bumped it up to mortal.
Yeah, I think you're right there. You know, you guys probably both know, and most of the listeners know, my brother Terry is now the chief foreign correspondent for ABC News. Used to be the anchor at for Nightline. And
I'm sure, go name dropping now.
Name dropping your own brother? What the hell?
I say PJ's an LA company. This is very LA. So yeah, go on. Name dropping.
I apologize. Anyway. Your brother is a very accomplished journalist, and I have nothing bad to say about your brother.
But I actually interviewed him, a two-part interview, when I re-kicked off the Rhino Hour of Power back in May. Yeah, and he had some interesting things to say about the media. I asked him, for instance, about Iraq war reporting. And whether, because so many of the journalists there stayed in the green zone rather than roam around the country and get shot at, which is probably pretty smart. I mean, if I'm a reporter and I have a family at home, I'm not going to be roaming around trying to get a story. So they had these stringers, Iraqis to go talk to the local police in a province, you know, 50 miles away. About a terrorist attack or whatever, and that's how they got most of the news. Now, I asked him about the vetting process for these stringers, and we vetted them. I said, well, you know, did you look into like whether or not they were working for Saddam Hussein, or whether they actually had ties to Sunni militias? Or he said, oh yeah, sort of. Most of what we were looking for was whether they were really journalists or not. he didn't seem upset about that. You know, if there's no other way to get the story, AP does the same thing, AFP does the same thing, Reuters does the same thing. They all employ these stringers, as well as these freelance photographers, who, as we found out with Reuters, can exaggerate photos to make it look like you know, huge bombs are going off when actually the explosions were rather small. But the question I'd like to ask you, Bridget, and it deals tangentially with this idea of substitute journalists covering stories. Now we have a lot more independent news gatherers out there actually contributing to people to broadcasts like CNN and Fox. And especially on MSNBC, you have, you know, independent TV news out of Great Britain. You have Al Jazeera is contributing reports to some people. You have to wonder what kind of vetting process goes on with those people, because it's going to happen a lot more now that the resources are drying up, and they're going to have to purchase these stories, to at least fill time.
Right, and you can fact check as best as you can, but some of the only way that you'll vet for sure on those is trial and error, where if you do have something and you have to weigh, you know, okay, is it worth me taking a risk on, say, an untested correspondent? And hopefully they have a background of, like, you know, some other good outlets that they've contributed to, so you can have a little bit of assurance there. You know, sometimes the story is so important and so unique that, you know, you decide that, okay, I'm going to take a chance and run this person's report. But the freelancer knows that, you know, one wrong move and you're not only going to lose your contract or your opportunities to sell to that news outlet, but word's going to get around to every other news outlet and you're not going to be able to work for anybody except, you know, Al Jazeera. I should note, though, as far as foreign correspondents go, some of them are very, very good. I know that I often turn to some of the Afghan news agencies like Tolo and Hama Press, because the way that these guys kind of, you know, came out of the underground, so to speak, after the fall of the Taliban and, you know, formed these news agencies, you know, they're very good, you know, brave journalists over there. And, you know, I'm able to find facts on, you know, attacks that have happened or, you know, things that are going on in the government there that the U.S. news hasn't even gotten around to yet. They can be very excellent sources. But like you said, they can also be untested sources.
Bridget, you're a little bit younger than me. Well, okay, you're probably.
She's a lot younger than you.
She's a lot younger than me.
Yes.
All right, fine. But you have a pretty good knowledge of history. And in the media, back in 2004, right around the time, shortly after the Iraq War started, there was, and this is one of my favorite pieces of media that was ever created. It was so inventive. A pair of people called Robin Sloan and Matt Thompson released a animation in 2004 that was called Epic 2014. And it was projecting a time that was just a few months back from now. And they talked about a future where there was something called Googlezon, where Google and Amazon had joined together and had created a news complex where everyone could tailor their own news to be exactly what they wanted it to be. And they could filter out the things they didn't like and amplify the things they did like. It's not exactly what happened a decade later, but with the rise of blogs and all that, it kind of is. And Rick brought up the point that, you know, now we have people fact-checking everything. We have people looking into every clip that goes out there. Have we gotten to the point where we are over-criticizing the media because we're now looking for just things that satisfy what we want to hear? I guess what I'm asking you is Brian Williams' sin that, you know, he got caught saying something bad and not true about himself, but we want to think that the media is biased and doing a bad job and we're too quick to take them down? Are we a little bit too eager to destroy the next Brian Williams?
I think that there is an overall knee-jerk towards, oh, it must be some big media conspiracy. I've had conversations a lot with people who, you know, think that a decision on a story to lean a certain way, you know, is attributable to one person when, you know, you have to explain, well, actually, no, this is how the editing process goes. And, you know, you explain that, you know, an editorial that comes out of the editorial board, for example, doesn't come from, you know, the city reporter sitting at his desk. But I think that one of the disappointments that I had when the Brian Williams story broke is, yeah, you had a lot of funny tweets, et cetera, But there was such a heated focus on it as, you know, oh, this just proves the evil of the mainstream media, et cetera, et cetera. And there was such a heavy focus on Brian Williams that there were a lot of other big stories going on at the time that I would have preferred that people, you know, put some attention on, from ISIS to, you know, to Yemen to et cetera, et cetera. That I thought that, you know, he was actually kind of conveniently almost draining news energy from some of these other stories that even the administration would like to see kind of, you know, kind of go away.
Yeah, he might have actually been a distraction from other things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that kind of thing, you know, demands, you know, meetings and phone calls and trysts in the night in a dark alley somewhere. I never buy that kind of crap. You know, and you know, it's interesting because you talk to a liberal about the news media, and it's the corporate media. The corporate media that shapes the news, according to advertisers. And if you talk to a conservative, it's the media that, you know, a much lower echelon going up to the editors and fact checkers and reporters. But the truth is that, you know, the upper echelons of management rarely kill or even, in fact, try to shape a story. And the opposite of that for conservatives is that they're reporting news that conservatives don't want to hear, so they're biased. I mean, it's basically it. Now, there is bias in the media, okay? Anybody who reads a New York Times story about Republicans knows this. Not so much the Washington Post anymore, but the New York Times for sure is a left-wing rag. There's just no two ways about it. But, you know, most of the media, and I'm talking the Chicago Tribune, the Denver Post, and I read a lot of these publications every day, you know, to find blog stories. So I just don't think that there is. If there is bias, and there sometimes is, it's more a product, Bridget, of laziness, because good reporters and good editors can remove bias from a story if they want to, if they work at it. But, you know, there are times when it just slips through, and you get outrageous things being written about, especially about conservatives.
Right. You know, I'm kind of thinking of one story I had once where, you know, a Republican senator was accused of something, and the reporter just reported the complaint. And it's like, okay, well, did you call the senator for comment? Well, no. Do I have to?
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, and I can say that, you know, from having been at the Hill newspaper, the Rocky Mountain News, LA Daily News, you know, other papers before that, newsrooms are mixed. Some people you don't even know, you know, what their political affiliations are. You know, some people, you know, we'll talk about it. I've rarely seen, you know, knockdown, drag out fights between people of different ideologies on a news desk or anything. And honestly, it wasn't until I started working at a conservative publication, PJ, that somebody asked me to shape a story a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, journalism ethics says no. And I had to explain to the Republican National Committee that they could not come and use me as a PR repository, you know. That
suppository,
no, you know,
yeah,
you're funny. Not going to get special treatment. And everybody's going to get reported on fairly.
Well, the managing editor. Go ahead, Jazz.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to say that's fair enough, but how much of that is bias, Bridget, and how much of it is click-worthiness? Because, and just to expand on that for people listening, you can do a story that's completely legitimate. You could find something out where somebody made a mistake on their job, and wow, this extra money had to be hidden or something like that. Oh, my God, we did, you know, a terrible mistake. But there could be another story where somebody is doing something that's a lot sexier And when I say sincere, I don't mean sexually. I mean, you know, something that it leads, it bleeds, et cetera. You know, if you can bring down the big dog, even if you have to bend the facts a little bit. And now we're coming full circle back to the Brian Williams thing. Maybe he didn't do anything that terrible in terms of what he was reporting. But that's a much bigger story than a guy who misspent $5,000 on the local community board about snow removal. I mean, is it sensationalism? Has the media fallen victim not so much to partisanship as to the need to sell?
That's a really excellent point, actually, because that was an internal debate that was had a lot over stories at when I was at The Hill, because, you know, that's a newspaper with strict, you know, K Street coverage roots, and, you know, was just kind of wading into the waters of starting to get picked up by Drudge, starting to get an audience outside of the Beltway. So when we had stories where, you know, Barney Frank wears a T-shirt on the House floor that looks like he has man boobs, versus, you know, a story that you know is a little drier, but was kind of the meat of what, you know.
All right, well, that was news. Let's all admit that was news.
That was news.
But we also debated all the time whether or not something was going to make it look like we had Democrat or Republican bias. If we were going to highlight a certain story that was more sensational, that was sexier, that was more likely to get picked up and spread around, and you know, those were discussions that were had a lot, I have to say. So no, that's a really good point.
Are either of you familiar with the Independent Journalism Review website? Probably not.
I don't check it, but I know of it.
Okay.
They routinely
get 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 shares on Facebook for their material, their articles and blogs and stuff like that. It's a sharing world today in the media, and because that brings you clicks to your website, and it generates ad revenue far more than a link, even a Drudge link, used to. Now, Drudge is still
Rick,
pretty.
Rick, can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yes.
Just for the people that are listening live. Both Drudge and Politico have just reported that Brian Williams has been suspended for 6 months without pay. So that ties into the conversation we're having.
That story is 40. Bridget mentioned that at the top of the show, didn't you, Bridget? When you said anybody is suspended that long, he's 6 months.
Yeah.
I thought everybody.
I hadn't seen confirmation of that, and it just winged across the TV, and I went and looked, and I was like, okay, I guess. He released a statement saying, yes,
the Atlantic, he's stepping down. It's all over. And in other news, Jazz, the sun is going to rise in the east tomorrow morning.
Oh, come on. Brian Williams went out and commented on it now. Okay? So.
He just made me throw my – I know. When we first started blogging, Jazz, you over at Middle Earth or whatever it was called, I liked the blog. I just kind of forget what the name was. And I was at Right Wing Nut House, and Ed Morrissey was at Captain's Quarters, and Powerline was big. And when blogs were blogs back in the period about 2002 to 2010, the big thing was links. You got to get links. You got to get all these links, hundreds of links. Well,
yes.
That doesn't matter like any crap today. You could get 50 links on a story and not get the kind of traffic you would if you got 1,000 shares on Facebook or Twitter. So
right.
It's a shared, a social media world today. And I think those media outlets, okay, Bridget, that adapt to that reality are going to survive, and those who can't adapt are going to fall. Would you agree with that?
And it's been very, very difficult for a lot of print outlets, and I'm even saying like Gannett, USA Today, et cetera, because I know some of the internal debates that they've had about this, because my ex-boyfriend is one of the editors there. But just trying to get a grasp on what happens in the online world is so difficult for a lot of these companies. And then, you know, like I said, there's a lot of resistance, too, from a lot of the veteran journalists to kind of participate in stories that kind of go in that line of thinking. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a hard slog.
Yeah. And, Jazz, I'll give you the last word because we got no time left, but I'll give you the last word because, hey, you're my friend.
I will take the last word, and I will just say, you know, Brian Williams, gone for 6 months, but I don't know that it was a mortal sin. And, Bridget, I'll just ask you, I mean, do we take anything from this as a larger lesson for the rest of the people who are anchoring, who are manning the big desks, who are out there? It's like, is there any room for forgiveness, or are we now just in a black and white, just the facts, ma'am, world?
I think we learned that word, that they're human, and like you said, sometimes they turn out to be like your drunk uncle.
Thank
so
you.
You gotta take personalities into account, and if somebody turns out not to be a fit for that position, turns out not to be trustworthy, then you move on.
And with that, we'll close out the broadcast. I want to thank our guest, Bridget Johnson of BJ Media, Washington editor there. Bridget, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Hey, always good being on with you guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Bridget.
And thank you to Jazz Shaw of Hot Air for sitting in once again in his role as show clown.
Always a pleasure. Next time I'll come on and do a rant about vaccines. So, you know, we'll go there.
Good. Good. We'll do that because, after all, vaccines are deadly, dangerous. They cause autism, and they cause people's heads to explode.
I am so stupid today because I was vaccinated. Otherwise, I would be successful. We all know this. I would be Brian Williams. Well, okay, not Brian Williams, but, you know, someone.
Someone. Anyway. Thanks a lot, Jazz. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Rick.
And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.